Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Chapter 5 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 5. It was late in the afternoon when the carriage containing little Lord Fauntleroy and Mr. Havisham drove up the long avenue which led to the castle. The Earl had given orders that his grandson should arrive in time to dine with him, and for some reason best known to himself, he had also ordered that the child should be sent alone into the room in which he intended to receive him. As the carriage rolled up the avenue, Lord Fauntleroy sat leaning comfortably against the luxurious cushions, and regarded the prospect with great interest. He was, in fact, interested in everything he saw. He had been interested in the carriage with its large, splendid horses and their glittering harness. He had been interested in the tall coachmen and footmen with their resplendent livery. And he had been especially interested in the coronet on the panels, and had struck up an acquaintance with the footman for the purpose of inquiring what it meant. When the carriage reached the great gates of the park, he looked out of the window to get a good view of the huge stone lions ornamenting the entrance. The gates were opened by a motherly, rosy-looking woman, who came out of a pretty, ivy-covered lodge. Two children ran out of the door of the house and stood looking with round, wide-open eyes at the little boy in the carriage, who looked at them also. Their mother stood curtsying and smiling, and the children, on receiving a sign from her, made bobbing little courtesies, too. "Does she know me?" asked Lord Fauntleroy. "I think she must think she knows me." And he took off his black velvet cap to her and smiled. "How do you do?" he said brightly. "Good afternoon!" The woman seemed pleased, he thought. The smile broadened on her rosy face, and a kind look came into her blue eyes. "God bless your lordship," she said. "God bless your pretty face. Good luck and happiness to your lordship. Welcome to you." Lord Fauntleroy waved his cap and nodded to her again as the carriage rolled by her. "I like that woman," he said. "She looks as if she liked boys. I should like to come here and play with her children. I wonder if she has enough to make up a company." Mr. Havisham did not tell him that he would scarcely be allowed to make playmates of the gatekeeper's children. The lawyer thought there was time enough for giving him that information. The carriage rolled on and on between the great, beautiful trees which grew on each side of the avenue and stretched their broad, swaying branches in an arch across it. Cedric had never seen such trees. They were so grand and stately, and their branches grew so low down on their huge trunks. He did not then know that Dorincourt Castle was one of the most beautiful in all England, that its park was one of the broadest and finest, and its trees and avenue almost without rivals. But he did know that it was all very beautiful. He liked the big, broad-branched trees, with the late afternoon sunlight striking golden lances through them. He liked the perfect stillness which rested on everything. He felt a great, strange pleasure in the beauty of which he caught glimpses under and between the sweeping boughs. The great, beautiful spaces of the park, with still other trees standing sometimes stately and alone, and sometimes in groups. Now and then they passed places where tall ferns grew in masses, and again the ground was azure with the bluebell swaying in the soft breeze. Several times he started up with a laugh of delight as a rabbit leaped up from under the greenery and scudded away with a twinkle of short white tail behind it. Once a covey of partridges rose with a sudden whirr and flew away, and then he shouted and clapped his hands. "It's a beautiful place, isn't it?" he said to Mr. Havisham. "I never saw such a beautiful place. It's prettier even than Central Park." He was rather puzzled by the length of time they were on their way. "How far is it," he said at length, "from the gate to the front door?" "It is between 3 and 4 miles," answered the lawyer. "That's a long way for a person to live from his gate," remarked his lordship. Every few minutes he saw something new to wonder at and admire. When he caught sight of the deer, some couched in the grass, some standing with their pretty antlered heads turned with a half-startled air toward the avenue as the carriage wheels disturbed them, he was enchanted. "Has there been a circus?" he cried. "Or do they live here always? Whose are they?"
"They live here," Mr. Havisham told him. "They belong to the Earl, your grandfather."
It was not long after this that they saw the castle. It rose up before them stately and beautiful and gray, the last rays of the sun casting dazzling lights on its many windows. It had turrets and battlements and towers. A great deal of ivy grew upon its walls. All the broad, open space about it was laid out in terraces and lawns and beds of brilliant flowers.
"It's the most beautiful place I ever saw," said Cedric, his round face flushing with pleasure. "It reminds anyone of a king's palace. I saw a picture of one once in a fairy book."
He saw the great entrance door thrown open and many servants standing in two lines looking at him. He wondered why they were standing there and admired their liveries very much. He did not know that they were there to do honor to the little boy to whom all this splendor would one day belong. The beautiful castle like the fairy king's palace, the magnificent park, the grand old trees, the dells full of ferns and bluebells where the hares and rabbits played, the dappled large-eyed deer couching in the green grass. It was only a couple of weeks since he had sat with Mr. Hobbs among the potatoes and canned peaches with his legs dangling from the high stool. It would not have been possible for him to realize that he had very much to do with all this grandeur. At the head of the line of servants there stood an elderly woman in a rich, plain black silk gown. She had gray hair and wore a cap. As he entered the hall, she stood nearer than the rest, and the child thought from the look in her eyes that she was going to speak to him. Mr. Havisham, who held his hand, paused a moment.
"This is Lord Fauntleroy, Mrs. Mellon," he said. "Lord Fauntleroy, this is Mrs. Mellon, who is the housekeeper."
Cedric gave her his hand, his eyes lighting up.
"Was it you who sent the cat?" he said. "I'm much obliged to you, ma'am."
Mrs. Mellon's handsome old face looked as pleased as the face of the lodgekeeper's wife had done.
"I should know his lordship anywhere," she said to Mr. Havisham. "He has the captain's face and way. It's a great day, this, sir."
Cedric wondered why it was a great day. He looked at Mrs. Mellon curiously. It seemed to him for a moment as if there were tears in her eyes, and yet it was evident she was not unhappy. She smiled down at him.
"The cat left 2 beautiful kittens here," she said. "They shall be sent up to your lordship's nursery."
Mr. Havisham said a few words to her in a low voice.
"In the library, sir," Mrs. Mellon replied. "His lordship is to be taken there alone."
A few minutes later, the very tall footman in livery, who had escorted Cedric to the library door, opened it and announced,
"Lord Fauntleroy, my lord,"
in quite a majestic tone. If he was only a footman, he felt it was rather a grand occasion when the heir came home to his own land and possessions and was ushered into the presence of the old earl, whose place and title he was to take. Cedric crossed the threshold into the room. It was a very large and splendid room, with massive carven furniture in it, and shelves upon shelves of books. The furniture was so dark and the draperies so heavy, the diamond-paned windows were so deep, and it seemed such a distance from one end of it to the other, that, since the sun had gone down, the effect of it was all rather gloomy. For a moment Cedric thought there was nobody in the room, but soon he saw that by the fire burning in the wide hearth there was a large easy-chair, and that in that chair someone was sitting, someone who did not at first turn to look at him. But he had attracted attention in one quarter at least. On the floor by the armchair lay a dog, a huge tawny mastiff, with body and limbs almost as big as a lion's. And this great creature rose majestically and slowly and marched toward the little fellow with a heavy step. Then the person in the chair spoke. "Dougal," he called, "come back, sir." But there was no more fear in little Lord Fauntleroy's heart than there was unkindness. He had been a brave little fellow all his life. He put his hand on the big dog's collar in the most natural way in the world, and they strayed forward together, Dougal sniffing as he went. And then the Earl looked up. What Cedric saw was a large old man with shaggy white hair and eyebrows, and a nose like an eagle's beak between his deep, fierce eyes. What the Earl saw was a graceful, childish figure in a black velvet suit with a lace collar and with love locks waving about the handsome, manly little face, whose eyes met his with a look of innocent good fellowship. If the castle was like the palace in a fairy story, it must be owned that little Lord Fauntleroy was himself rather like a small copy of the fairy prince, though he was not at all aware of the fact, and perhaps was rather a sturdy young model of a fairy. But there was a sudden glow of triumph and exultation in the fiery old Earl's heart as he saw what a strong, beautiful boy this grandson was, and how unhesitatingly he looked up as he stood with his hand on the big dog's neck. It pleased the grim old nobleman that the child should show no shyness or fear, either of the dog or of himself. Cedric looked at him just as he had looked at the woman at the lodge and at the housekeeper, and came quite close to him. "Are you the Earl?" he said. "I'm your grandson, you know, that Mr. Havisham brought. I'm Lord Fauntleroy." He held out his hand because he thought it must be the polite and proper thing to do, even with earls. "I hope you are very well," he continued, with the utmost friendliness. "I'm very glad to see you." The Earl shook hands with him with a curious gleam in his eyes. Just at first, he was so astonished that he scarcely knew what to say. He stared at the picturesque little apparition from under his shaggy brows and took it all in from head to foot. "Glad to see me, are you?" he said.
"Yes," answered Lord Fauntleroy. "Very."
There was a chair near him, and he sat down on it. It was a high-backed, rather tall chair, and his feet did not touch the floor when he had settled himself in it. But he seemed to be quite comfortable as he sat there, and regarded his august relative intently but modestly. "I've kept wondering what you would look like," he remarked. "I used to lie in my berth in the ship and wonder if you would be anything like my father."
"Am I?" asked the Earl.
"Well," Cedric replied, "I was very young when he died, and I may not remember exactly how he looked, but I don't think you are like him."
"You are disappointed, I suppose," suggested his grandfather.
"Oh, no," responded Cedric politely. "Of course you would like anyone to look like your father, but of course you would enjoy the way your grandfather looked, even if he wasn't like your father. You know how it is yourself about admiring your relations."
The Earl leaned back in his chair and stared. He could not be said to know how it was about admiring his relations. He had employed most of his noble leisure in quarreling violently with them,
in turning them out of his house, and applying abusive epithets to them, and they all hated him cordially.
"Any boy would love his grandfather," continued Lord Fauntleroy, "especially one that had been as kind to him as you have been." Another queer gleam came into the old nobleman's eyes.
"Oh," he said, "I've been kind to you, have I?"
"Yes," answered Lord Fauntleroy brightly. "I'm ever so much obliged to you about Bridget and the apple woman and Dick."
"Bridget!" exclaimed the Earl. "Dick, the apple woman?"
"Yes," explained Cedric. "The ones you gave me all that money for. The money you told Mr. Havisham to give me if I wanted it."
"Ha!" ejaculated his lordship. "That's it, is it? The money you were to spend as you liked. What did you buy with it? I should like to hear something about that."
He drew his shaggy eyebrows together and looked at the child sharply. He was secretly curious to know in what way the lad had indulged himself. "Oh," said Lord Fauntleroy, "perhaps you didn't know about Dick and the apple woman and Bridget. I forgot you live such a long way off from them. They are particular friends of mine. And you see, Michael had the fever."
"Who's Michael?" asked the Earl.
"Michael is Bridget's husband, and they were in great trouble. When a man is sick and can't work and has 12 children, you know how it is. And Michael has always been a sober man. And Bridget used to come to our house and cry. And the evening Mr. Havisham was there, she was in the kitchen crying because they had almost nothing to eat and couldn't pay the rent. And I went in to see her. And Mr. Havisham sent for me, and he said you had given him some money for me. And I ran as fast as I could into the kitchen and gave it to Bridget. And that made it all right. And Bridget could scarcely believe her eyes. That's why I'm so obliged to you."
"Oh," said the Earl in his deep voice. "That was one of the things you did for yourself, was it? What else?"
Dougal had been sitting by the tall chair. The great dog had taken its place there when Cedric sat down. Several times it had turned and looked up at the boy as if interested in the conversation. Dougal was a solemn dog who seemed to feel altogether too big to take life's responsibilities lightly. The old Earl, who knew the dog well, had watched it with secret interest. Dougal was not a dog whose habit it was to make acquaintances rashly, and the Earl wondered somewhat to see how quietly the brute sat under the touch of the childish hand. And, just at this moment, the big dog gave little Lord Fauntleroy one more look of dignified scrutiny and deliberately laid its huge lion-like head on the boy's black velvet knee. The small hand went on stroking this new friend as Cedric answered.
"Well, there was Dick," he said. "You'd like Dick. He's so square."
This was an Americanism the Earl was not prepared for.
"What does that mean?" he inquired.
Lord Fauntleroy paused a moment to reflect. He was not very sure himself what it meant. He had taken it for granted as meaning something very creditable because Dick had been fond of using it.
"I think it means that he wouldn't cheat anyone," he exclaimed, "or hit a boy who was under his size. And that he blacks people's boots very well and makes them shine as much as he can. He's a professional boot black."
"And he's one of your acquaintances, is he?" said the Earl.
"He is an old friend of mine," replied his grandson. "Not quite as old as Mr. Hobbs, but quite old. He gave me a present just before the ship sailed."
He put his hand into his pocket and drew forth a neatly folded red object and opened it with an air of affectionate pride. It was the red silk handkerchief with the large purple horseshoes and heads on it.
"He gave me this," said his young lordship. "I shall keep it always. You can wear it round your neck or keep it in your pocket. He bought it with the first money he earned after I bought Jake out and gave him the new brushes. It's a keepsake. I put some poetry in Mr. Hobbs' watch. It was, 'When this you see, remember me. When this I see, I shall always remember Dick.'"
The sensations of the Right Honorable the Earl of Dorincourt could scarcely be described. He was not an old nobleman who was very easily bewildered, because he had seen a great deal of the world. But here was something he found so novel that it almost took his lordly breath away and caused him some singular emotions. He had never cared for children,
He had been so occupied with his own pleasures that he had never had time to care for them. His own sons had not interested him when they were very young, though sometimes he remembered having thought Cedric's father a handsome and strong little fellow. He had been so selfish himself that he had missed the pleasure of seeing unselfishness in others, and he had not known how tender and faithful and affectionate a kind-hearted little child can be, and how innocent and unconscious are its simple, generous impulses. A boy had always seemed to him a most objectionable little animal, selfish and greedy and boisterous when not under strict restraint. His own two eldest sons had given their tutors constant trouble and annoyance, and of the younger one he fancied he had heard few complaints because the boy was of no particular importance. It had never once occurred to him that he should like his grandson. He had sent for little Cedric because his pride impelled him to do so. If the boy was to take his place in the future, he did not wish his name to be made ridiculous by descending to an uneducated boor. He had been convinced the boy would be a clownish fellow if he were brought up in America. He had no feeling of affection for the lad. His only hope was that he should find him decently well-featured and with a respectable share of sense. He had been so disappointed in his other sons and had been made so furious by Captain Errol's American marriage that he had never once thought that anything creditable could come of it. When the footman had announced Lord Fauntleroy, he had almost dreaded to look at the boy, lest he should find him all that he had feared. It was because of this feeling that he had ordered that the child should be sent to him alone. His pride could not endure that others should see his disappointment, if he was to be disappointed. His proud, stubborn old heart, therefore, had leaped within him when the boy came forward with his graceful, easy carriage, his fearless hand on the big dog's neck. Even in the moments when he had hoped the most, the Earl had never hoped that his grandson would look like that. It seemed almost too good to be true that this should be the boy he had dreaded to see, the child of the woman he so disliked. This little fellow with so much beauty and such a brave, childish grace. The Earl's stern composure was quite shaken by this startling surprise. And then their talk began, and he was still more curiously moved and more puzzled. In the first place, he was so used to seeing people rather afraid and embarrassed before him that he had expected nothing else but that his grandson would be timid or shy. But Cedric was no more afraid of the Earl than he had been of Dougal. He was not bold. He was only innocently friendly. And he was not conscious that there could be any reason why he should be awkward or afraid. The Earl could not help seeing that the little boy took him for a friend and treated him as one, without having any doubt of him at all. It was quite plain, as the little fellow sat there in his tall chair and talked in his friendly way, that it had never occurred to him that this large, fierce-looking old man could be anything but kind to him, and rather pleased to see him there. And it was plain, too, that, in his childish way, he wished to please and interest his grandfather. Cross and hard-hearted and worldly as the old Earl was, he could not help feeling a secret and novel pleasure in this very confidence. After all, it was not disagreeable to meet someone who did not distrust him or shrink from him or seem to detect the ugly part of his nature, someone who looked at him with clear, unsuspecting eyes, if it was only a little boy in a black velvet suit. So the old man leaned back in his chair and led his young companion on to tell him still more of himself, and with that odd gleam in his eyes, watched the little fellow as he talked. Lord Fauntleroy was quite willing to answer all his questions and chatted on in his genial little way, quite composedly. He told him all about Dick and Jake and the apple woman and Mr. Hobbs. He described the Republican rally in all the glory of its banners and transparencies, torches and rockets. In the course of the conversation, he reached the 4th of July and the Revolution, and was just becoming enthusiastic when he suddenly recollected something and stopped very abruptly. "What is the matter?" demanded his grandfather. "Why don't you go on?" Lord Fauntleroy moved rather uneasily in his chair. It was evident to the Earl that he was embarrassed by the thought which had just occurred to him.
"I was just thinking that perhaps you mightn't like it," he replied. "Perhaps someone belonging to you might have been there.
"I forgot you were an Englishman."
"You can go on," said my lord. "No one belonging to me was there."
"You forgot you were an Englishman, too."
"Oh, no," said Cedric quickly. "I'm an American."
"You are an Englishman," said the Earl grimly. "Your father was an Englishman."
It amused him a little to say this, but it did not amuse Cedric. The lad had never thought of such a development as this. He felt himself grow quite hot up to the roots of his hair.
"I was born in America," he protested. "You have to be an American if you are born in America. I beg your pardon," with serious politeness and delicacy, "for contradicting you. Mr. Hobbs told me if there were another war, you know, I should have to be an American."
The Earl gave a grim half laugh. It was short and grim, but it was a laugh.
"You would you?" he said.
He hated America and Americans, but it amused him to see how serious and interested this small patriot was. He thought that so good an American might make a rather good Englishman when he was a man. They had not time to go very deep into the Revolution again, and indeed, Lord Fauntleroy felt some delicacy about returning to the subject before dinner was announced. Cedric left his chair and went to his noble kinsman. He looked down at his gouty foot.
"Would you like me to help you?" he said politely. "You could lean on me, you know. Once, when Mr. Hobbs hurt his foot with a potato barrel rolling on it, he used to lean on me."
The big footman almost periled his reputation and his situation by smiling. He was an aristocratic footman who had always lived in the best of noble families, and he had never smiled. Indeed, he would have felt himself a disgraced and vulgar footman if he had allowed himself to be led by any circumstance whatever into such an indiscretion as a smile. But he had a very narrow escape. He only just saved himself by staring straight over the Earl's head at a very ugly picture. The Earl looked his valiant young relative over from head to foot.
"Do you think you could do it?" he asked gruffly.
"I think I could," said Cedric. "I'm strong. I'm 7, you know. You could lean on your stick on one side and on me on the other. Dick says I've a good deal of muscle for a boy that's only 7.
He shut his hand and moved it upward to his shoulder so that the Earl might see the muscle Dick had kindly approved of, and his face was so grave and earnest that the footman found it necessary to look very hard indeed at the ugly picture.
"Well," said the Earl, "you may try."
Cedric gave him his stick and began to assist him to rise. Usually the footman did this, and was violently sworn at when his lordship had an extra twinge of gout. The Earl was not a very polite person as a rule, and many a time the huge footmen about him quaked inside their imposing liveries. But this evening he did not swear, though his gouty foot gave him more twinges than one. He chose to try an experiment. He got up slowly and put his hand on the small shoulder presented to him with so much courage. Little Lord Fauntleroy made a careful step forward, looking down at the gouty foot.
"Just lean on me," he said, with encouraging good cheer. "I'll walk very slowly."
If the Earl had been supported by the footman, he would have rested less on his stick and more on his assistant's arm. And yet it was part of his experiment to let his grandson feel his burden as no light weight. It was quite a heavy weight indeed, and after a few steps his young lordship's face grew quite hot, and his heart beat rather fast, but he braced himself sturdily, remembering his muscle and Dick's approval of it.
"Don't be afraid of leaning on me," he panted. "I'm all right if it isn't a very long way."
It was not really very far to the dining room, but it seemed rather a long way to Cedric before they reached the chair at the head of the table. The hand on his shoulder seemed to grow heavier at every step, and his face grew redder and hotter, and his breath shorter. But he never thought of giving up. He stiffened his childish muscles, held his head erect, and encouraged the Earl as he limped along.
"Does your foot hurt you very much when you stand on it?" he asked. "Did you ever put it in hot water and mustard? Mr. Hobbs used to put his in hot water. Arnica is a very nice thing, they tell me."
The big dog stalked slowly beside them, and the big footman followed. Several times he looked very queer as he watched the little figure making the very most of all its strength and bearing its burden with such good will. The Earl, too, looked rather queer once as he glanced sideways down at the flushed little face. When they entered the room where they were to dine, Cedric saw that it was a very large and imposing one, and that the footman who stood beside the chair at the head of the table stared very hard as they came in. But they reached the chair at last. The hand was removed from his shoulder, and the Earl was fairly seated. Cedric took out Dick's handkerchief and wiped his forehead.
"It's a warm night, isn't it?" he said. "Perhaps you need a fire because of your foot, but it seems just a little warm to me."
His delicate consideration for his noble relative's feelings was such that he did not wish to seem to intimate that any of his surroundings were unnecessary.
"You have been doing some rather hard work," said the Earl.
"Oh, no," said Lord Fauntleroy. "It wasn't exactly hard, but I got a little warm. A person will get warm in summertime."
And he rubbed his damp curls rather vigorously with the gorgeous handkerchief. His own chair was placed at the other end of the table, opposite his grandfather's. It was a chair with arms, and intended for a much larger individual than himself. Indeed, everything he had seen so far, the great rooms with their high ceilings, the massive furniture, the big footman, the big dog, the Earl himself, were all of proportions calculated to make this little lad feel that he was very small indeed. But that did not trouble him. He had never thought himself very large or important, and he was quite willing to accommodate himself even to circumstances which rather overpowered him. Perhaps he had never looked so little a fellow as when seated now in his great chair at the end of the table. Notwithstanding his solitary existence, the Earl chose to live in some state. He was fond of his dinner, and he dined in formal style. Cedric looked at him across a glitter of splendid glass and plate, which to his unaccustomed eyes seemed quite dazzling. A stranger looking on might well have smiled at the picture. The great stately room, the big liveried servants, the bright lights, the glittering silver and glass, the fierce-looking old nobleman at the head of the table, and the very small boy at the foot. Dinner was usually a very serious matter with the Earl, and it was a very serious matter with the cook if his lordship was not pleased or had an indifferent appetite. Today, however, his appetite seemed a trifle better than usual, perhaps because he had something to think of beside the flavor of the entrees and the management of the gravies. His grandson gave him something to think of. He kept looking at him across the table. He did not say very much himself, but he managed to make the boy talk. He had never imagined that he could be entertained by hearing a child talk, but Lord Fauntleroy at once puzzled and amused him, and he kept remembering how he had let the childish shoulder feel his weight just for the sake of trying how far the boy's courage and endurance would go. And it pleased him to know that his grandson had not quailed and had not seemed to think even for a moment of giving up what he had undertaken to do.
"You don't wear your coronet all the time?" remarked Lord Fauntleroy respectfully.
"No," replied the Earl with his grim smile. "It is not becoming to me."
"Mr. Hobbs said you always wore it," said Cedric. "But after he thought it over, he said he supposed you must sometimes take it off to put your hat on."
"Yes," said the Earl. "I take it off occasionally."
And one of the footmen suddenly turned aside and gave a singular little cough behind his hand. Cedric finished his dinner first, and then he leaned back in his chair and took a survey of the room.
"You must be very proud of your house," he said. "It's such a beautiful house. I never saw anything so beautiful, but, of course, as I'm only 7, I haven't seen much."
"And you think I must be proud of it, do you?" said the Earl.
"I should think anyone would be proud of it," said Lord Fauntleroy. "I should be proud of it if it were my house. Everything about it is beautiful. And the park, and those trees. How beautiful they are, and how the leaves rustle."
Then he paused an instant and looked across the table rather wistfully.
"It's a very big house for just 2 people to live in, isn't it?" he said.
"It's quite large enough for two," answered the Earl. "Do you find it too large?"
His little lordship hesitated a moment.
"I was only thinking," he said, "that if two people lived in it who were not very good companions, they might feel lonely sometimes."
"Do you think I shall make a good companion?" inquired the Earl.
"Yes," replied Cedric, "I think you will. Mr. Hobbs and I were great friends. He was the best friend I had, except Dearest."
The Earl made a quick movement of his bushy eyebrows.
"Who is Dearest?"
"She is my mother," said Lord Fauntleroy in a rather low, quiet little voice. Perhaps he was a trifle tired, as his bedtime was nearing, and perhaps after the excitement of the last few days it was natural he should be tired. So perhaps, too, the feeling of weariness brought to him a vague sense of loneliness and the remembrance that tonight he was not to sleep at home, watched over by the loving eyes of that best friend of his. They had always been best friends, this boy and his young mother. He could not help thinking of her, and the more he thought of her, the less he was inclined to talk. And by the time dinner was at an end, the Earl saw that there was a faint shadow on his face. But Cedric bore himself with excellent courage, and when they went back to the library, though the tall footman walked on one side of his master, the Earl's hand rested on his grandson's shoulder, though not so heavily as before. When the footman left them alone, Cedric sat down upon the hearthrug near Dougal. For a few minutes he stroked the dog's ears in silence and looked at the fire. The Earl watched him. The boy's eyes looked wistful and thoughtful, and once or twice he gave a little sigh. The Earl sat still and kept his eyes fixed on his grandson.
"Fauntleroy," he said at last, "what are you thinking of?"
Fauntleroy looked up with a manful effort at a smile.
"I was thinking about Dearest," he said, and I think I'd better get up and walk up and down the room."
He rose up and put his hands in his small pockets and began to walk to and fro. His eyes were very bright, and his lips were pressed together, but he kept his head up and walked firmly. Dougal moved lazily and looked at him, and then stood up. He walked over to the child and began to follow him uneasily. Fauntleroy drew one hand from his pocket and laid it on the dog's head.
"He's a very nice dog," he said. "He's my friend. He knows how I feel."
"How do you feel?" asked the Earl.
It disturbed him to see the struggle the little fellow was having with his first feelings of homesickness, but it pleased him to see that he was making so brave an effort to bear it well. He liked this childish courage.
"Come here," he said.
Fauntleroy went to him.
"I was never away from my own house before," said the boy, with a troubled look in his brown eyes. "It makes a person feel a strange feeling when he has to stay all night in another person's castle instead of in his own house. But Dearest is not very far away from me. She told me to remember that, and I'm 7, and I can look at the picture she gave me."
He put his hand in his pocket and brought out a small violet velvet-covered case.
"This is it," he said. "You see, you press this spring, and it opens, and she is in there."
He had come close to the Earl's chair, and as he drew forth the little case, he leaned against the arm of it, and against the old man's arm, too, as confidingly as if children had always leaned there.
"There she is," he said, as the case opened, and he looked up with a smile.
The Earl knitted his brows. He did not wish to see the picture, but he looked at it in spite of himself. And there looked up at him from it such a pretty young face, a face so like the child's at his side, that it quite startled him.
"I suppose you think you are very fond of her," he said.
"Yes," answered Lord Fauntleroy in a gentle tone and with simple directness.
"I do think so, and I think it's true. You see, Mr. Hobbs was my friend, and Dick and Bridget and Mary and Michael, they were my friends too, but Dearest, well, she is my close friend, and we always tell each other everything. My father left her to me to take care of, and when I am a man, I am going to work and earn money for her."
"What do you think of doing?"
inquired his grandfather. His young lordship slipped down upon the hearthrug and sat there with the picture still in his hand. He seemed to be reflecting seriously before he answered. "I did think perhaps I might go into business with Mr. Hobbs," he said, "but I should like to be a president."
"We'll send you to the House of Lords instead," said his grandfather.
"Well," remarked Lord Fauntleroy, "if I couldn't be a president, and if that's a good business, I shouldn't mind. The grocery business is dull sometimes."
Perhaps he was weighing the matter in his mind, for he sat very quiet after this and looked at the fire for some time. The Earl did not speak again. He leaned back in his chair and watched him. A great many strange new thoughts passed through the old nobleman's mind. Dougal had stretched himself out and gone to sleep with his head on his huge paws. There was a long silence. In about half an hour's time, Mr. Havisham was ushered in. The great room was very still when he entered. The Earl was still leaning back in his chair. He moved as Mr. Havisham approached and held up his hand in a gesture of warning. It seemed as if he had scarcely intended to make the gesture, as if it were almost involuntary. Dougal was still asleep, and close beside the great dog, sleeping also, with his curly head upon his arm, lay little Lord Fauntleroy. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Frances Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 6. When Lord Fauntleroy wakened in the morning, he had not wakened at all when he had been carried to bed the night before. The first sounds he was conscious of were the crackling of a wood fire and the murmur of voices. "You will be careful, Dawson, not to say anything about it," he heard someone say. "He does not know why she is not to be with him, and the reason is to be kept from him." "If them's his lordship's order, mim," another voice answered, "they'll have to be kept, I suppose. But if you'll excuse the liberty, mim, as it's between ourselves, servant or no servant, all I have to say is, it's a cruel thing, parting that poor, pretty, young, widdered creature from her own flesh and blood, and him such a little beauty and a nobleman born. James and Thomas, mim, last night in the servants' hall, they both of them say as they never seen anything in their two lives, nor yet no other gentleman in livery, like that little fellow's ways, as innocent and polite and interested as if he'd been sitting there dining with his best friend. And the temper of an angel, instead of one, if you'll excuse me, mim, as it's well known, is enough to curdle your blood in your veins at times. And as to looks, mim, when we was rung for, James and me, to go into the library and bring him upstairs, and James lifted him up in his arms, what with his little innocent face all red and rosy, and his little head on James's shoulder, and his hair hanging down all curly and shining, a prettier takener sight you'd never wish to see. And it's my opinion my lord wasn't blind to it neither, for he looked at him, and he says to James, 'See you don't wake him,' he says." Cedric moved on his pillow and turned over, opening his eyes. There were two women in the room. Everything was bright and cheerful with gay-flowered chintz. There was a fire on the hearth, and the sunshine was streaming in through the ivy-entwined windows. Both women came toward him, and he saw that one of them was Mrs. Mellon, the housekeeper, and the other a comfortable middle-aged woman with a face as kind and good-humored as a face could be. "Good morning, my lord," said Mrs. Mellon. "Did you sleep well?" His lordship rubbed his eyes and smiled. "Good morning," he said. "I didn't know I was here." "You were carried upstairs when you were asleep," said the housekeeper. "This is your bedroom, and this is Dawson, who is to take care of you." Fauntleroy sat up in bed and held out his hand to Dawson as he had held it out to the Earl.
"How do you do, ma'am?" he said. "I'm much obliged to you for coming to take care of me."
"You can call her Dawson, my lord," said the housekeeper with a smile. "She is used to being called Dawson."
"Miss Dawson or Mrs. Dawson?" inquired his lordship.
"Just Dawson, my lord," said Dawson herself, beaming all over. "Neither Miss nor Mrs., bless your little heart. Will you get up now and let Dawson dress you, and then have your breakfast in the nursery?"
"I learned to dress myself many years ago, thank you," answered Fauntleroy. "Dearest taught me. Dearest is my mamma. We had only Mary to do all the work, washing and all, and so, of course, it wouldn't do to give her so much trouble. I can take my bath, too, pretty well, if you'd just be kind enough to examine the corners after I'm done."
Dawson and the housekeeper exchanged glances.
"Dawson will do anything you ask her to," said Mrs. Mellon.
"That I will, bless him," said Dawson in her comforting, good-humored voice.
"He shall dress himself if he likes, and I'll stand by, ready to help him if he wants me."
"Thank you," responded Lord Fauntleroy. "It's a little hard sometimes about the buttons, you know, and then I have to ask somebody."
He thought Dawson a very kind woman, and before the bath and the dressing were finished, they were excellent friends, and he had found out a great deal about her. He had discovered that her husband had been a soldier and had been killed in a real battle, and that her son was a sailor and was away on a long cruise, and that he had seen pirates and cannibals and Chinese people and Turks, and that he had brought home strange shells and pieces of coral, which Dawson was ready to show at any moment, some of them being in her trunk. All this was very interesting. He also found out that she had taken care of little children all her life, and that she had just come from a great house in another part of England, where she had been taking care of a beautiful little girl whose name was Lady Gwyneth Vaughan.
"And she is a sort of relation of your lordship's," said Dawson, "and perhaps sometime you may see her."
"Do you think I shall?" said Fauntleroy. "I should like that. I never knew any little girls, but I always like to look at them."
When he went into the adjoining room to take his breakfast, and saw what a great room it was, and found there was another adjoining it, which Dawson told him was his also, the feeling that he was very small indeed came over him again so strongly that he confided it to Dawson as he sat down to the table on which the pretty breakfast service was arranged.
"I am a very little boy," he said rather wistfully, "to live in such a large castle and have so many big rooms. Don't you think so?"
"Oh, come," said Dawson.
"You feel just a little strange at first, that's all. But you'll get over that very soon, and then you'll like it here. It's such a beautiful place, you know."
"It's a very beautiful place, of course," said Fauntleroy with a little sigh.
"But I should like it better if I didn't miss Dearest so. I always had my breakfast with her in the morning, and put the sugar and cream in her tea for her, and handed her the toast. That made it very sociable, of course."
"Oh, well," answered Dawson comfortingly, "you know you can see her every day. And there's no knowing how much you'll have to tell her. Bless you! Wait till you've walked about a bit and seen things. The dogs and the stables with all the horses in them. There's one of them I know you'll like to see."
"Is there?" exclaimed Fauntleroy. "I'm very fond of horses. I was very fond of Jim. He was the horse that belonged to Mr. Hobbs' grocery wagon. He was a beautiful horse when he wasn't balky."
"Well," said Dawson, "you just wait till you've seen what's in the stables. And, deary me, you haven't looked even into the very next room yet."
"What is there?" asked Fauntleroy.
"Wait until you've had your breakfast, and then you shall see," said Dawson. At this he naturally began to grow curious, and he applied himself assiduously to his breakfast. It seemed to him that there must be something worth looking at in the next room. Dawson had such a consequential, mysterious air.
"Now then," he said, slipping off his seat a few minutes later, "I've had enough. Can I go and look at it?"
Dawson nodded and led the way, looking more mysterious and important than ever.
he began to be very much interested indeed. When she opened the door of the room, he stood upon the threshold and looked about him in amazement. He did not speak. He only put his hands in his pockets and stood there, flushing up to his forehead and looking in. He flushed up because he was so surprised and, for the moment, excited. To see such a place was enough to surprise any ordinary boy. The room was a large one, too, as all the rooms seemed to be, and it appeared to him more beautiful than the rest, only in a different way. The furniture was not so massive and antique as was that in the rooms he had seen downstairs. The draperies and rugs and walls were brighter. There were shelves full of books, and on the tables were numbers of toys, beautiful, ingenious things, such as he had looked at with wonder and delight through the shop windows in New York. "It looks like a boy's room," he said at last, catching his breath a little. "Whom do they belong to?"
"Go and look at them," said Dawson. "They belong to you."
"To me?" he cried. "To me? Why do they belong to me? Who gave them to me?" And he sprang forward with a gay little shout. It seemed almost too much to be believed. "It was Grandpapa," he said, with his eyes as bright as stars. "I know it was Grandpapa."
"Yes, it was his lordship," said Dawson. "And if you will be a nice little gentleman and not fret about things and will enjoy yourself and be happy all the day, he will give you anything you ask for." It was a tremendously exciting morning. There were so many things to be examined, so many experiments to be tried. Each novelty was so absorbing that he could scarcely turn from it to look at the next. And it was so curious to know all this had been prepared for himself alone, that even before he had left New York, people had come down from London to arrange the rooms he was to occupy, and had provided the books and playthings most likely to interest him.
"Did you ever know anyone," he said to Dawson, "who had such a kind grandfather?"
Dawson's face wore an uncertain expression for a moment. She had not a very high opinion of his lordship the Earl. She had not been in the house many days, but she had been there long enough to hear the old nobleman's peculiarities discussed very freely in the servants' hall.
"And of all the vicious, savage, hill-tempered old fellows, it was ever my hill luck to wear livery under," the tallest footman had said. "He's the wilentest and wust by a long shot."
And this particular footman, whose name was Thomas, had also repeated to his companions below stairs some of the Earl's remarks to Mr. Havisham when they had been discussing these very preparations.
"Give him his own way and fill his room with toys," my lord had said. "Give him what will amuse him, and he'll forget about his mother quickly enough. Amuse him, and fill his mind with other things, and we shall have no trouble. That's boy nature."
So perhaps, having had this truly amiable object in view, it did not please him so very much to find it did not seem to be exactly this particular boy's nature. The Earl had passed a bad night, and had spent the morning in his room. But at noon, after he had lunched, he sent for his grandson. Fauntleroy answered the summons at once. He came down the broad staircase with a bounding step. The Earl heard him run across the hall, and then the door opened, and he came in with red cheeks and sparkling eyes.
"I was waiting for you to send for me," he said. "I was ready a long time ago. I'm ever so much obliged to you for all those things. I'm ever so much obliged to you. I have been playing with them all the morning."
"Oh," said the Earl, "you like them, do you?"
"I like them so much, well, I couldn't tell you how much," said Fauntleroy, his face glowing with delight. "There's one that's like baseball, only you play it on a board with black and white pegs, and you keep your score with some counters on a wire. I tried to teach Dawson, but she couldn't quite understand it just at first. You see, she never played baseball, being a lady, and I'm afraid I wasn't very good at explaining it to her. But you know all about it, don't you?"
"I'm afraid I don't," replied the Earl. "It's an American game, isn't it? Is it something like cricket?"
"I never saw cricket," said Fauntleroy, "but Mr. Hobbs took me several times to see baseball. It's a splendid game. You get so excited. "Would you like me to go and get my game and show it to you? Perhaps it would amuse you and make you forget about your foot. Does your foot hurt you very much this morning?"
"More than I enjoy," was the answer.
"Then perhaps you couldn't forget it," said the little fellow anxiously. "Perhaps it would bother you to be told about the game. Do you think it would amuse you, or do you think it would bother you?"
"Go and get it," said the Earl.
It was certainly a novel entertainment, this, making a companion of a child who offered to teach him to play games. But the very novelty of it amused him. There was a smile lurking about the Earl's mouth when Cedric came back with the box containing the game in his arms, and an expression of the most eager interest on his face.
"May I pull that little table over here to your chair?" he asked.
"Ring for Thomas," said the Earl. "He will place it for you."
"Oh, I can do it myself," answered Fauntleroy. "It's not very heavy."
"Very well," replied his grandfather.
The lurking smile deepened on the old man's face as he watched the little fellow's preparations. There was such an absorbed interest in them. The small table was dragged forward and placed by his chair, and the game taken from its box and arranged upon it.
"It's very interesting once you begin," said Fauntleroy. "You see, the black pegs can be your side and the white ones mine. They're men, you know, and once round the field is a home run and counts one. And these are outs, and here is the first base, and that's the second, and that's the third, and that's the home base."
He entered into the details of explanation with the greatest animation. He showed all the attitudes of pitcher and catcher and batter in the real game, and gave a dramatic description of a wonderful hot ball he had seen caught on the glorious occasion on which he had witnessed a match in company with Mr. Hobbs. His vigorous, graceful little body, his eager gestures, his simple enjoyment of it all, were pleasant to behold. When at last the explanations and illustrations were at an end and the game began in good earnest, the Earl still found himself entertained. His young companion was wholly absorbed. He played with all his childish heart, his gay little laughs when he made a good throw, his enthusiasm over a home run, his impartial delight over his own good luck and his opponents, would have given a flavor to any game. If, a week before, anyone had told the Earl of Dorincourt that on that particular morning he would be forgetting his gout and his bad temper in a child's game, played with black and white wooden pegs on a gaily painted board, with a curly-headed small boy for a companion, he would without doubt have made himself very unpleasant. And yet he certainly had forgotten himself, when the door opened and Thomas announced a visitor. The visitor in question, who was an elderly gentleman in black and no less a person than the clergyman of the parish, was so startled by the amazing scene which met his eye that he almost fell back a pace and ran some risk of colliding with Thomas. There was, in fact, no part of his duty that the Reverend Mr. Mordaunt found so decidedly unpleasant as that part which compelled him to call upon his noble patron at the castle. His noble patron, indeed, usually made these visits as disagreeable as it lay in his lordly power to make them. He abhorred churches and charities, and flew into violent rages when any of his tenantry took the liberty of being poor and ill and needing assistance. When his gout was at its worst, he did not hesitate to announce that he would not be bored and irritated by being told stories of their miserable misfortunes. When his gout troubled him less, and he was in a somewhat more humane frame of mind, he would perhaps give the rector some money, after having bullied him in the most painful manner, and berated the whole parish for its shiftlessness and imbecility. But, whatsoever his mood, he never failed to make as many sarcastic and embarrassing speeches as possible, and to cause the Reverend Mr. Mordaunt to wish it were proper and Christian-like to throw something heavy at him. During all the years in which Mr. Mordaunt had been in charge of Dorincourt Parish, the rector certainly did not remember having seen his lordship, of his own free will, do anyone a kindness, or, under any circumstances whatever, show that he thought of anyone but himself. He had called today to speak to him of a specially pressing case, and as he had walked up the avenue, he had, for two reasons, dreaded his visit more than usual. In the first place, he knew that his lordship had for several days been suffering with the gout, and had been in so villainous a humor that rumors of it had even reached the village.
carried there by one of the young women servants to her sister, who kept a little shop and retailed darning needles and cotton and peppermints and gossip as a means of earning an honest living. What Mrs. Dibble did not know about the castle and its inmates, and the farmhouses and their inmates, and the village and its population, was really not worth being talked about. And, of course, she knew everything about the castle, because her sister, Jane Shorts, was one of the upper housemaids, and was very friendly and intimate with Thomas.
"And the way his lordship do go on," said Mrs. Dibble over the counter, "and the way he do use language, Mr. Thomas told Jane herself, no flesh and blood as is in livery could stand, for throw a plate of toast at Mr. Thomas hisself he did, not more than 2 days since. And if it weren't for other things being agreeable, and the society below stairs most genteel, warning would have been gave within an hour."
And the rector had heard all this, for somehow the Earl was a favorite black sheep in the cottages and farmhouses, and his bad behavior gave many a good woman something to talk about when she had company to tea. And the second reason was even worse, because it was a new one and had been talked about with the most excited interest. Who did not know of the old nobleman's fury when his handsome son, the captain, had married the American lady? Who did not know how cruelly he had treated the captain, and how the big, gay, sweet-smiling young man, who was the only member of the grand family anyone liked, had died in a foreign land, poor and unforgiven? Who did not know how fiercely his lordship had hated the poor young creature who had been his son's wife, and how he had hated the thought of her child, and never meant to see the boy, until his two sons died and left him without an heir? And then, who did not know that he had looked forward without any affection or pleasure to his grandson's coming, and that he had made up his mind that he should find the boy a vulgar, awkward, pert American lad, more likely to disgrace his noble name than to honor it? The proud, angry old man thought he had kept all his thoughts secret. He did not suppose anyone dared to guess at, much less talk over, what he felt and dreaded. But his servants watched him, and read his face, and his ill humors, and fits of gloom, and discussed them in the servants' hall. And while he thought himself quite secure from the common herd, Thomas was telling Jane and the cook and the butler and the housemaids and the other footmen that it was his opinion that the whole man was worse than usual a-thinking over the captain's boy, and anticipating as he won't be no credit to the family. "And serve him right," added Thomas. "It's his own fault. What can he expect from a child brought up in poor circumstances in that there low America?" And as the Reverend Mr. Mordaunt walked under the great trees, he remembered that this questionable little boy had arrived at the castle only the evening before, and that there were 9 chances to 1 that his lordship's worst fears were realized, and 22 chances to 1 that if the poor little fellow had disappointed him, the Earl was even now in a tearing rage, and ready to vent all his rancor on the first person who called, which it appeared probable would be his reverend self. Judge, then, of his amazement when, as Thomas opened the library door, his ears were greeted by a delighted ring of childish laughter.
"That's 2 out!" shouted an excited, clear little voice. "You see, it's 2 out!"
And there was the Earl's chair, and the gout stool, and his foot on it, and by him a small table, and a game on it, and quite close to him, actually leaning against his arm and his ungouty knee, was a little boy with face glowing and eyes dancing with excitement.
"It's 2 out!" the little stranger cried. "You hadn't any luck that time, had you?"
And then they both recognized at once that someone had come in. The Earl glanced around, knitting his shaggy eyebrows as he had a trick of doing. And when he saw who it was, Mr. Mordaunt was still more surprised to see that he looked even less disagreeable than usual, instead of more so. In fact, he looked almost as if he had forgotten for the moment how disagreeable he was, and how unpleasant he really could make himself when he tried.
"Ah," he said in his harsh voice, but giving his hand rather graciously. "Good morning, Mordaunt. I've found a new employment, you see."
He put his other hand on Cedric's shoulder,
Perhaps deep down in his heart there was a stir of gratified pride that it was such an heir he had to present. There was a spark of something like pleasure in his eyes as he moved the boy slightly forward.
"This is the new Lord Fauntleroy," he said. "Fauntleroy, this is Mr. Mordaunt, the rector of the parish."
Fauntleroy looked up at the gentleman in the clerical garments and gave him his hand.
"I am very glad to make your acquaintance, sir," he said, remembering the words he had heard Mr. Hobbs use on one or two occasions when he had been greeting a new customer with ceremony.
Cedric felt quite sure that one ought to be more than usually polite to a minister. Mr. Mordaunt held the small hand in his a moment as he looked down at the child's face, smiling involuntarily. He liked the little fellow from that instant, as in fact people always did like him. And it was not the boy's beauty and grace which most appealed to him. It was the simple, natural kindliness in the little lad which made any words he uttered, however quaint and unexpected, sound pleasant and sincere. As the rector looked at Cedric, he forgot to think of the Earl at all. Nothing in the world is so strong as a kind heart, and somehow this kind little heart, though it was only the heart of a child, seemed to clear all the atmosphere of the big gloomy room and make it brighter.
"I am delighted to make your acquaintance, Lord Fauntleroy," said the rector. "You made a long journey to come to us. A great many people will be glad to know you made it safely."
"It was a long way," answered Fauntleroy. "But, dearest, my mother was with me, and I wasn't lonely. Of course, you are never lonely if your mother is with you, and the ship was beautiful."
"Take a chair, Mordaunt," said the Earl.
Mr. Mordaunt sat down. He glanced from Fauntleroy to the Earl.
"Your lordship is greatly to be congratulated," he said warmly.
But the Earl plainly had no intention of showing his feelings on the subject.
"He is like his father," he said rather gruffly. "Let us hope he'll conduct himself more creditably."
And then he added,
"Well, what is it this morning, Mordaunt? Who is in trouble now?"
This was not as bad as Mr. Mordaunt had expected, but he hesitated a second before he began.
"It is Higgins," he said. "Higgins of Edge Farm. He has been very unfortunate. He was ill himself last autumn, and his children had scarlet fever. I can't say that he is a very good manager, but he has had ill luck, and of course he is behindhand in many ways. He is in trouble about his rent now. Newick tells him if he doesn't pay it, he must leave the place, and of course that would be a very serious matter. His wife is ill, and he came to me yesterday to beg me to see about it and ask you for time. He thinks if you would give him time, he could catch up again."
"They all think that," said the Earl, looking rather black.
Fauntleroy made a movement forward. He had been standing between his grandfather and the visitor, listening with all his might. He had begun to be interested in Higgins at once. He wondered how many children there were, and if the scarlet fever had hurt them very much. His eyes were wide open and were fixed upon Mr. Mordaunt with intent interest as that gentleman went on with the conversation.
"Higgins is a well-meaning man," said the rector, making an effort to strengthen his plea. "He is a bad enough tenant," replied his lordship, "and he is always behindhand, Newick tells me."
"He is in great trouble now," said the rector. "He is very fond of his wife and children, and if the farm is taken away from him, they may literally starve. He cannot give them the nourishing things they need. Two of the children were left very low after the fever, and the doctor orders for them wine and luxuries that Higgins cannot afford." At this, Fauntleroy moved a step nearer.
"That was the way with Michael," he said.
The Earl slightly started.
"I forgot you," he said. "I forgot we had a philanthropist in the room. Who was Michael?"
And the gleam of queer amusement came back into the old man's deep-set eyes.
"He was Bridget's husband, who had the fever," answered Fauntleroy, "and he couldn't pay the rent or buy wine and things. And you gave me that money to help him."
The Earl drew his brows together in a curious frown, which somehow was scarcely grim at all. He glanced across at Mr. Mordaunt.
"I don't know what sort of landed proprietor he will make," he said. I told Havisham the boy was to have what he wanted, anything he wanted. And what he wanted, it seems, was money to give to beggars."
"Oh, but they weren't beggars," said Fauntleroy eagerly. "Michael was a splendid bricklayer. They all worked."
"Oh," said the Earl, "they were not beggars. They were splendid bricklayers and bootblacks and apple women."
He bent his gaze on the boy for a few seconds in silence. The fact was that a new thought was coming to him, and though, perhaps, it was not prompted by the noblest emotions, it was not a bad thought.
"Come here," he said at last.
Fauntleroy went and stood as near to him as possible, without encroaching on the gouty foot.
"What would you do in this case?" his lordship asked.
It must be confessed that Mr. Mordaunt experienced for the moment a curious sensation. Being a man of great thoughtfulness, and having spent so many years on the estate of Dorincourt knowing the tenantry, rich and poor, the people of the village, honest and industrious, dishonest and lazy, he realized very strongly what power for good or evil would be given in the future to this one small boy standing there, his brown eyes wide open, his hands deep in his pockets. And the thought came to him also that a great deal of power might, perhaps, through the caprice of a proud, self-indulgent old man, be given to him now, and that if his young nature were not a simple and generous one, it might be the worst thing that could happen, not only for others, but for himself.
"And what would you do in such a case?" demanded the Earl.
Fauntleroy drew a little nearer and laid one hand on his knee with a most confiding air of good comradeship.
"If I were very rich," he said, "and not only just a little boy, I should let him stay and give him the things for his children, but then I am only a boy."
Then, after a second's pause in which his face brightened visibly,
"You can do anything, can't you?" he said.
"Humph," said my lord, staring at him. "That's your opinion, is it?"
And he was not displeased either.
"I mean, you can give anyone anything," said Fauntleroy. "Who's Newick?"
"He is my agent," answered the Earl, "and some of my tenants are not over fond of him."
"Are you going to write him a letter now?" inquired Fauntleroy. "Shall I bring you the pen and ink? I can take the game off this table."
It plainly had not for an instant occurred to him that Newick would be allowed to do his worst. The Earl paused a moment, still looking at him.
"Can you write?" he asked.
"Yes," answered Cedric, "but not very well."
"Move the things from the table," commanded my lord, "and bring the pen and ink and a sheet of paper from my desk."
Mr. Mordaunt's interest began to increase. Fauntleroy did as he was told very deftly. In a few moments, the sheet of paper, the big inkstand, and the pen were ready.
"There!" he said gaily. "Now you can write it."
"You are to write it," said the Earl.
"I!" exclaimed Fauntleroy,
and a flush overspread his forehead.
"Will it do if I write it? I don't always spell quite right when I haven't a dictionary, and nobody tells me."
"It will do," answered the Earl. "Higgins will not complain of the spelling. I'm not the philanthropist. You are. Dip your pen in the ink."
Fauntleroy took up the pen and dipped it in the ink bottle. Then he arranged himself in position, leaning on the table.
"Now," he inquired, "what must I say?"
"You may say, 'Higgins is not to be interfered with for the present,' and sign it 'Fauntleroy,'" said the Earl.
Fauntleroy dipped his pen in the ink again and, resting his arm, began to write. It was rather a slow and serious process, but he gave his whole soul to it. After a while, however, the manuscript was complete, and he handed it to his grandfather with a smile slightly tinged with anxiety.
"Do you think it will do?" he asked.
The Earl looked at it, and the corners of his mouth twitched a little.
"Yes," he answered. "Higgins will find it entirely satisfactory."
And he handed it to Mr. Mordaunt. What Mr. Mordaunt found written was this:
"Dear Mr. Newick, if you please, Mr. Higgins is not to be interfered with for the present, and oblige, yours respectfully, Fauntleroy." "Mr. Hobbs always signed his letters that way," said Fauntleroy, "and I thought I'd better say please. Is that exactly the right way to spell interfered?"
"It is not exactly the way it is spelled in the dictionary," answered the Earl.
"I was afraid of that," said Fauntleroy. "I ought to have asked. You see, that's the way with words of more than one syllable. You have to look in the dictionary. It's always safest. I'll write it over again." And write it over again he did, making quite an imposing copy and taking precautions in the matter of spelling by consulting the Earl himself. "Spelling is a curious thing," he said. "It's so often different from what you expect it to be. I used to think please was spelled P-L-E-E-S, but it isn't, you know. And you'd think dear was spelled D-E-R-E if you didn't inquire. Sometimes it almost discourages you." When Mr. Mordaunt went away, he took the letter with him. And he took something else with him also, namely, a pleasanter feeling and a more hopeful one than he had ever carried home with him down that avenue on any previous visit he had made at Dorincourt Castle. When he was gone, Fauntleroy, who had accompanied him to the door, went back to his grandfather. "May I go to Dearest now?" he asked. "I think she will be waiting for me." The Earl was silent a moment.
"There is something in the stable for you to see first," he said. "Ring the bell."
"If you please," said Fauntleroy with his quick little flush. "I'm very much obliged, but I think I'd better see it tomorrow. She will be expecting me all the time."
"Very well," answered the Earl. "We will order the carriage."
Then he added dryly,
"It's a pony."
Fauntleroy drew a long breath. "A pony!" he exclaimed. "Whose pony is it?"
"Yours," replied the Earl.
"Mine?" cried the little fellow. "Mine? Like the things upstairs?"
"Yes," said his grandfather. "Would you like to see it? Shall I order it to be brought around?"
Fauntleroy's cheeks grew redder and redder. "I never thought I should have a pony," he said. "I never thought that. How glad Dearest will be. You give me everything, don't you?"
"Do you wish to see it?" inquired the Earl.
Fauntleroy drew a long breath. "I want to see it," he said. "I want to see it so much I can hardly wait, but I'm afraid there isn't time."
"You must go and see your mother this afternoon?" asked the Earl. "You think you can't put it off?"
"Why," said Fauntleroy, "she has been thinking about me all the morning, and I have been thinking about her."
"Oh," said the Earl, "you have you? Ring the bell."
As they drove down the avenue under the arching trees, he was rather silent. But Fauntleroy was not. He talked about the pony. What color was it? How big was it? What was his name? What did it like to eat best? How old was it? How early in the morning might he get up and see it? "Dearest will be so glad," he kept saying. "She will be so much obliged to you for being so kind to me. She knows I always liked ponies so much, but we never thought I should have one. There was a little boy on Fifth Avenue who had one, and he used to ride out every morning, and we used to take a walk past his house to see him." He leaned back against the cushions and regarded the Earl with rapt interest for a few minutes and an entire silence. "I think you must be the best person in the world," he burst forth at last. "You are always doing good, aren't you? And thinking about other people. Dearest says that is the best kind of goodness, not to think about yourself, but to think about other people. That's just the way you are, isn't it?" His lordship was so dumbfounded to find himself presented in such agreeable colors that he did not know exactly what to say. He felt that he needed time for reflection. To see each of his ugly, selfish motives changed into a good and generous one by the simplicity of a child was a singular experience. Fauntleroy went on, still regarding him with admiring eyes, those great, clear, innocent eyes. "You make so many people happy," he said. There's Michael and Bridget and their 10 children, and the apple woman, and Dick, and Mr. Hobbs, and Mr. Higgins, and Mrs. Higgins, and their children, and Mr. Mordaunt, because, of course, he was glad, and Dearest and me about the pony and all the other things. Do you know? I've counted it up on my fingers and in my mind, and it's 27 people you've been kind to. That's a good many, 27.
And I was the person who was kind to them, was I? Said the Earl.
Why, yes, you know, answered Fauntleroy. You made them all happy. Do you know, with some delicate hesitation, that people are sometimes mistaken about earls when they don't know them? Mr. Hobbs was. I am going to write him and tell him about it.
What was Mr. Hobbs' opinion of earls? Asked his lordship.
Well, you see, the difficulty was, replied his young companion, that he didn't know any, and he'd only read about them in books. He thought, you mustn't mind it, that they were gory tyrants, and he said he wouldn't have them hanging around his store. But if he'd known you, I'm sure he would have felt quite different. I shall tell him about you.
What shall you tell him?
I shall tell him, said Fauntleroy, glowing with enthusiasm, that you are the kindest man I ever heard of. And you are always thinking of other people and making them happy, and I hope when I grow up, I shall be just like you.
Just like me, repeated his lordship, looking at the little kindling face.
And a dull red crept up under his withered skin, and he suddenly turned his eyes away and looked out of the carriage window at the great beech trees with the sun shining on their glossy red-brown leaves.
"Just like you," said Fauntleroy, adding modestly, "if I can. Perhaps I'm not good enough, but I'm going to try."
The carriage rolled on down the stately avenue under the beautiful broad-branched trees, through the spaces of green shade and lanes of golden sunlight. Fauntleroy saw again the lovely places where the ferns grew high and the bluebells swayed in the breeze. He saw the deer, standing or lying in the deep grass, turn their large startled eyes as the carriage passed, and caught glimpses of the brown rabbits as they scurried away. He heard the whir of the partridges and the calls and songs of the birds, and it all seemed even more beautiful to him than before. All his heart was filled with pleasure and happiness in the beauty that was on every side. But the old earl saw and heard very different things, though he was apparently looking out too. He saw a long life in which there had been neither generous deeds nor kind thoughts. He saw years in which a man who had been young and strong and rich and powerful had used his youth and strength and wealth and power only to please himself and kill time as the days and years succeeded each other. He saw this man, when the time had been killed and old age had come, solitary and without real friends in the midst of all his splendid wealth. He saw people who disliked or feared him, and people who would flatter and cringe to him, but no one who really cared whether he lived or died, unless they had something to gain or lose by it. He looked out on the broad acres which belonged to him, and he knew what Fauntleroy did not, how far they extended, what wealth they represented, and how many people had homes on their soil. And he knew, too, another thing Fauntleroy did not, that in all those homes, humble or well-to-do, there was probably not one person, however much he envied the wealth and stately name and power, and however willing he would have been to possess them, who would for an instant have thought of calling the noble owner good, or wishing, as this simple-souled little boy had, to be like him. And it was not exactly pleasant to reflect upon, even for a cynical, worldly old man, who had been sufficient unto himself for 70 years, and who had never deigned to care what opinion the world held of him, so long as it did not interfere with his comfort or entertainment. And the fact was, indeed, that he had never before condescended to reflect upon it at all, and he only did so now because a child had believed him better than he was, and by wishing to follow in his illustrious footsteps and imitate his example, had suggested to him the curious question whether he was exactly the person to take as a model.
Fauntleroy thought the Earl's foot must be hurting him. His brows knitted themselves together so, as he looked out at the park, and thinking this, the considerate little fellow tried not to disturb him and enjoyed the trees and the ferns and the deer in silence. But at last the carriage, having passed the gates and bowled through the green lanes for a short distance, stopped. They had reached Court Lodge, and Fauntleroy was out upon the ground almost before the big footman had time to open the carriage door. The Earl wakened from his reverie with a start.
"What?" he said. "Are we here?"
"Yes," said Fauntleroy. "Let me give you your stick. Just lean on me when you get out."
"I am not going to get out," replied his lordship brusquely.
Not to see Dearest?" exclaimed Fauntleroy with an astonished face.
"Dearest will excuse me," said the Earl dryly. "Go to her and tell her that not even a new pony would keep you away."
"She will be disappointed," said Fauntleroy. "She will want to see you very much."
"I am afraid not," was the answer. "The carriage will call for you as we come back. Tell Jeffreys to drive on, Thomas."
Thomas closed the carriage door, and after a puzzled look, Fauntleroy ran up the drive. The Earl had the opportunity, as Mr. Havisham once had, of seeing a pair of handsome, strong little legs flash over the ground with astonishing rapidity. Evidently their owner had no intention of losing any time. The carriage rolled slowly away, but his lordship did not at once lean back. He still looked out. Through a space in the trees, he could see the house door. It was wide open. The little figure dashed up the steps. Another figure, a little figure too, slender and young in its black gown, ran to meet it. It seemed as if they flew together, as Fauntleroy leaped into his mother's arms, hanging about her neck and covering her sweet young face with kisses. End of chapter 6.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.